last lecture on pure differential geometry. And today we're going to start talking about physics, so it's going to be fun. So eventually we're going to start talking about, you know, the dynamics of space-time itself, but that actually won't come for a few lectures. I think maybe in two or three lectures Achim will deal with dynamics of space-time. Because first, it's sort of more natural because we know that, you know, the dynamics of space-time are sourced by matter and energy, that really we should start talking about the matter and the energy first and stress energy tensors and things like that. So the dynamics of curved space-time, that'll come up in a couple lectures. So today, we're just going to be focusing on dynamics of matter in curved space-time and how, you know, you go from the special relativistic equations of motion and talk about how it works on curved space-time. So matter, a convention in GRs, matter is you know, everything that's not the gravitational field. So it's different than, you know, you talk about in high energy. So today we're going to talk about matter fields, and then next lecture or two, I think, that's going to set up to talk about energy momentum tensors. And I think Achim's going to spend some time talking about things like energy conditions and things like that, which are going to be important later. And then, you know, eventually you'll get to the dynamics of curved space-time. But, okay, so for today, matter on curved space-time. So how do we do it? Well, we're going to, like, given that we know how it works in special relativity, given that we know how it works in special relativity, we're going to be using the two sort of guiding principles of GR. It's the principle of general covariance and the principle of equivalence. And these are going to basically tell us how to do the dynamics of matter fields on curved space-time. So first, okay, let's talk about general covariance. We're not going to talk too much about it, but so Achim says that, recall, on a pseudo-Riemannian manifold, equations are well-defined only if defined independently of any chart. And, for me, I'll belabor this a little bit. For me, like, this is really where general covariance, like, the deep physical significance of general covariance comes in. Because before now, you talked about the idea that, okay, you have coordinate charts on your manifold, and there's no really preferred set of coordinate charts you're going to want to use, so you just pick an arbitrary set of coordinates. But at the end of the day, we don't really care about, you know, coordinatizing and defining, or talking about points on our manifold. That's not really what we care about. We care about physical objects and you know, coincidences of, you know, coordinate values and physical trajectories, like trajectories of particles, right? So, like, you know, if I took this hockey stick, right, and I threw it across the room, okay, then, you know, you might set up a coordinate system like here, here, and here, and shoot out geodesics and use the clock, and that's your coordinate system. You can describe the trajectory of this thing. But, you know, I might come along and, you know, I'm not very smart, so I'm going to shoot out geodesics like this way, and this way, and use, like, my heart rate to measure the time. So that's not very smart. But, or, you know, over here I could use his heart rate and shoot out geodesics this way, and this way, right? And the point is, as long as I know how to translate your coordinates to my coordinates, we should agree on the physical trajectory of the hockey stick going across the room. And my point is that the significance of general covariance really only comes in when you start talking about dynamics. So it really starts now where it comes into play. And beforehand, it's just talking about, you know, some mathematical thing that we, at the end of the day, for physical purposes, we don't really care about. Okay, so I belabor that a bit. I think that's important to understand. But for today, we're just going to be very practical about this. And we're going to interpret this as saying any equation, including the equations of motions for matter field, must be equations among tensors and their covariant derivatives. So that's just a very practical mathematical statement of what we mean by that. It's not actually, and there's sort of some few different, not quite equivalent ways of stating these things. Like how I stated that is not quite how this is stated. It's mathematically just a little bit different. But this is how we're going to interpret it today. I got to be careful not to skip slides here. So matter fields, what are they? Well, we're going to talk about them as being tensor fields, and we're going to have a different field for each species of particle. So we have electrons, quarks, gluons, et cetera, et cetera. And the notation Achim uses is psi, and then an index that labels the species of the particle. So you can call, you know, I electron, like something like this, And then they're going to be tensorial objects, so they're going to have contravariant and covariant indices. Right, and then he has a note here that any spinner equation can also be expressed as a complicated tensor equation. Now, he says, see example Hawking and Ellis, page 59. Now, I looked this up last night, and Hawking and Ellis basically just say this. but they reference some paper from like the late 30s that I couldn't find. So I really have no idea what this is talking about. But apparently you can do it. But I mean, at the end of the day, we know, you know, because we've done things like this before, that as long as, you know, everything, you put everything in your action, all your internal and external indices are contracted at the end of the day, so we get a scalar. We can talk about spinorial indices too without much problem, but apparently you can write them as tensorial indices if you really want. Okay, so now Achim raises this other question. I think this first part's basically based on Hawking and Ellis. So they ask this question, could we also have additional connection fields in our action? So we have this sort of nice Levi-Civita connection, which remembers the unique torsion-free metric-compatible connection on a Riemannian manifold. And that's sort of the natural one to use in your action. We're talking about covariant derivatives of tensorial fields in your action. That's a natural one to use. But what if we decided, you know, we're going to use some different connection other than the Levi-Civita connection when we're taking covariant derivatives of these tensor fields? Now, it turns out we could do that, but it doesn't really matter. And I'll tell you why. So first, before I tell you why, we have to notice that, or show, that the difference in any two connections is actually a tensor. And so the way to show that is just using the physicist's way of defining tensors. So if you think of how the Christoffel symbols change under a coordinate transformation, so that was in some previous lecture, you've done this before, it just looks like this. And if we take a different connection and also look at it, at the coordinate change, then we notice, so this part, I mean, if this term wasn't here, right, this part would be tensorial, right? Because these indices change tensorially. But what makes this not a tensor is this term here. But if you'll notice, this term doesn't depend on the connection. So if we subtract these two connections, these two terms cancel, and we just get these Jacobian factors in front of the difference of the connection. So the difference, so this shows that the difference of two connections is a tensorial object. And so what that means is we might as well, I mean, we could introduce additional connection fields, some other non-Levi-Civita connection fields, but we could always take the difference. So like if we had something like, I'm going to suppress like all the indices, but like, non-Levi-Civita connection acting on some vector field, right? We could always write that as this minus the other connection field, the Levi-Civita connection, right? And then we can just use that in our covariant derivatives. So if we had like, right, we can just take this as a covariant derivative, and then what this looks like, Achim calls this Q, that's just some tensorial field. So all it looks like is that we're introducing extra fields into the theory. So the point is we might as well just work with the Levi-Civita connection in the action, and then, you know, if we want to use some other action instead, we can just, or some other Levi-Civita, some other affine connection. We can just introduce extra fields. So at this sort of level, we can talk about it sort of without loss of generality. So that's that. And right. And one other thing is that because the difference of connection fields is tensorial, this won't come up today. This will come up later. It turns out that means that the variations in connection fields will also behave tensorially. So that's just something to remember in a couple lectures when you do like the Einstein-Hilbert action. That'll come up. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, good. Okay. Yeah?
Are there any geometric definition for the Q, for the difference of the connection?
What do you mean? Sorry, say that again.
Geometric version of the difference of connection.
I don't know what you mean by geometric.
I mean, since the affine connection is actually doing the parallel transport.
Right. Well, I mean, any affine connection is some kind of parallel transport, right?
So do you have any geometric version to the difference of the...
No, all I'm saying is like the Levi-Civita connection is the one that's torsion-free Mechtrich compatible, right? So that's a special connection. But you could consider some other kind of connection. Say, you know, I wanted to describe parallel transport, but using with some torsion or something like that, right?
Okay.
Because, you know, in my favorite theory, that's how it works, right? But the point is, like, okay, if you just take differences like this, you might as well, it's equivalent to just introducing some extra fields. And then it's basically, you can describe it as the usual connection with the usual, I mean, with the Levi-Civita parallel transport. And then you're going to predict that there are other fields in the universe. And then you have to go check to see if you see those fields, right? And it's sort of equivalent to having a non-Levi-Civita connection. That makes sense?
Yeah.
That makes sense, everyone? Okay, right, so how do we get the equations of motion for matter fields? Well, we're going to go and use an action principle, just like you do in special relativity or any other, lots of other favorite physical theories. So any theory of matter, theory of matter can be defined by specifying a Lagrangian function, which is some real-valued scalar function of the matter fields, and the first covariant derivatives. And now that we're working on a curved background, we're going to allow it to depend on the metric field as well. So matter Lagrangian is all of these tensorial objects, their first covariant derivatives, and the metric. And I mean, we want this to be a scalar, right? So that's why we use the covariant derivatives here. So we can contract the tensorial indices and get a scalar at the end of the day. Okay. So that's the general setup. Okay, then once you have a Lagrangian as a function of the matter fields, you can define an action functional, which is this. So we have this scalar, right? So this is a scalar function of the matter fields. And then we're going to integrate that over the invariant volume form, which is the square root metric factor and the volume, or the d4x. And then we're just going to consider it over some bounded region of the manifold. That just makes it a little bit cleaner dealing with this. You don't have to do it. You could take the whole manifold and then assume variations die off at infinity. But for here, we're just going to consider a bounded region of spacetime. Right, and remember these fields are both functions of space and time. And you integrate over some space-time region, and then it just gives you a number for every field configuration, or for every set of field configurations. And now remember Hamilton's principle, or the action principle, or postulate of classical physics, is just that in nature, the fields, the physical fields, should be such that this is extremized in the space of fields. So you should remember that just from other physics. Right, and we don't really care if it's a maximum or minimum. We just want it to be extremal. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, we mean some functional derivative of the action. So the action is a functional in the space of field configurations, and the functional derivative with respect to the fields should vanish. And then this will end up being the equations of motion for the matter fields. Okay, so how do you define this thing? Well, we're not going to be too formal about this, but I mean, if you want to be really picky, you can define this quite rigorously if you want. So, like, but what you have to do is if you like really specify or really precisely say what these field configurations live in, like, for example, most of the time, actually, you assume they come from some Hilbert space, like some kind of Sobolev space or something. Or a Banach space more generally. And then you can define this as something called a Fréchet derivative, which is just some, I mean, if you want to talk to functional analysis analysts, they you know, they'll talk about these kind of things. But more generally, you can consider it like in a topological vector space, and then you can define it as a Gâteau derivative. There's lots of things you can do, and it really sort of depends on the physical problem you have in mind. And that can be important sometimes, but we're not going to be picky about it today. I'm just going to tell you how to do it. So we're going to define a variation of the fields in this bounded region. So we'll add a point, and this point's going to come from this bounded region that we're integrating over for action functional. So this bounded region. Oops. Sorry, I got to get used to this. Right, so add a point in bounded region. And then we're going to define this as a one-parameter deformation. So we're going to define these fields with this extra parameter, and this comes from some finite interval of the real line, so some open interval. And this is going to be what we're going to call a deformation parameter. And now, what do we want these to do? Well, we want it so that if the deformation parameter is zero, we want to just get the field configuration, sort of non-deformed field configuration. And then the fact that we're only varying in this bounded region, we're going to quantify that like this. So we're saying for if P, so if the point is outside this bounded region, no matter what the deformation parameter is, we don't want it to be varied. So it's this undeformed field configuration. Right, so I should have mentioned, like, we're varying around some fixed field configuration, right? It's an arbitrary field configuration, but it's around this field configuration. So that's the undeformed one. And then we're saying, OK, deformation parameter is zero. It's not deformed. And outside this region, it's not deformed. So that's just the way to say that. OK, and then we can define this variation precisely just as the partial derivative of this thing with respect to lambda. And then at lambda equals zero. And that gives you a little bit better handle on what we mean by an action principle. So what we're saying is that this, as a function of the deformed operator, or the deformed field configuration, you take the partial derivative with respect to lambda, set lambda equals zero, and then assume that holds for all variations, and you get something like this. And then we'll get the equations of motion. Okay, great. So what does that actually look like? This is sort of the same kind of thing you would do in any other classical physics. It's just a little bit more picky about how we're actually defining these variations, right? Take this derivative here, and what we get is the partial derivative with respect to Lagrangian with respect to all the field configurations, and then we're summing over all of the different species of particles, and the variation is going to be out here, and these indices are all going to be contracted with each other. And remember, this is just using the chain rule, right? So dl by d field configuration by d lambda, and that's what we defined as our variation. And then you do the same thing for the covariant derivatives, and you get this term here. Right, because by assumption, this also depends on the first covariant derivative. And then we're going to deal with these two terms separately, or actually this term separately, because this is where we're going to get our boundary term from. Now, okay, so variation of the covariant derivative is equal to the covariant derivative of the variation. And why is that? I mean, it's simple to see when you're not talking about covariant derivatives, when you're just talking about partial derivatives. So what we're going to do is look at the origin of some geodesic coordinate system. So that's the coordinate system where the metric's flat and the Christoffel symbols vanish. So the covariant derivative on these things is just the same as the partial derivative at that point. And then remember this variation we defined as partial derivative with respect to lambda. And now if in the geodesic coordinate system, we're just taking partial derivative with respect to the coordinates. And now these are going to commute at each point. At the center of the geodesic coordinate system, but then you can do that same thing at every point in the space-time, go to geodesic coordinate system at an arbitrary point, and so that will hold at any point. And so that's how you prove that. It's a sketch of how you prove that anyway. Right, and so the second term, so you can commute the covariant derivative past the variation. And now we're going to use the Leibniz rule, because remember, these covariant derivatives on tensors obey the Leibniz rule. So that's how we get to here. So we have the covariant derivative on the 2 minus the covariant derivative of this part and the variation. And then Atkin calls this whole thing a vector field KE. And that KE, so that first term here, this part, is going to turn it into a boundary term. So this is just rewriting it just as KE. And now we see that this, so this turns out just to be the divergence of K in the volume. So he left this as an exercise that show that for any vector field, if you can take a covariant derivative, contract it, and multiply it by a volume form, it's just the divergence of the vector field in the volume. So remember, the divergence he defined this way is the Lie, you use the Lie derivative to act on the volume form with this vector field, and then you can work that out. This is just a form, so you can work that out, representation of Lie derivative on forms, and you get something that looks like this. And then it reduces to showing that this is the same as this thing. And actually, if you work that out in coordinates, it's just this sort of really well-known identity that you use in GR all the time. That if you have some vector field, and you take a partial derivative of the vector field with the metric inside, you're allowed to commute this outside, but then you have to take a covariant derivative of this A. So that's something that comes up in GR all the time. If you write that out in coordinates, it just looks like this. But this only holds like for vector fields and as long as this is contracted. But so that's basically how you show, that's the coordinate version of how you show that kind of thing. Now, once you have this, remember, so the divergence you wrote as this. So then you have an integral of D and then contraction of this with K. And so you can use Stokes' theorem, or Gauss's theorem, basically, from here to here, and you get the integral of the contraction of the volume form with K over the boundary. And then, so we're saying K is going to be proportional to the variation, and then remember we said the variation vanishes outside this bounded region, so it's also going to vary, so we're going to say, okay, it varies on the boundary. The variation disappears on the boundary. And so this thing will go away. Right, the property two of variations, that was just the fact that it varies outside. And so this boundary term vanishes. Now, one thing about this, though, is that sometimes that doesn't work out so cleanly, and I'm just gonna assume it's gonna work for here, but if you've done action principles for GR before, you know that the boundary term doesn't really vanish. It's because when you do this, you end up with normal derivatives of the metric field with respect to the boundary. So you don't actually get that the variations vanish on the boundary. But when that happens, you can do this trick where you go back to your original action and just subtract off a boundary term. And then when you go through this whole thing again, you get a boundary term minus another boundary term. And then you cook it up so those things cancel. But for matter fields, that usually doesn't come up, so we're not going to worry about it. I'm going to let Achim deal with that when he talks about GR. So for here, we're going to assume the boundary term vanishes. And basically what that means is that the variational principle is well-defined in this case. And so, if you want to talk mathematically, it's saying that the Fréchet derivative of this thing is well-defined in this case. So at the end of the day, the boundary term vanishes, and you just get this thing. And then if you assume this holds, assuming this holds for all variations, you get the Euler-Lagrange equations. And these should look kind of familiar from special relativity, or you may have seen this before other places. So you get one of these for each species of particle, and then a whole bunch of indices, a whole mess of indices. And these are going to be the equations of motion for the matter fields. Okay, so any questions? Is that bad? Is that clear? Okay, so that's the very sort of formal general structure. So now I'm going to talk about some examples. So the first example we're going to look at is a scalar field, a real valued scalar field. And so these kind of scalar fields describe things like pi zero mesons, or which are just quark any quark pairs, or inflaton fields, or like Higgs fields, or things like that. Right, so I told you the general structure of these Lagrangians, but I didn't actually tell you how to cook up these Lagrangians for these field theories. Basically, what you do is you appeal to the equivalence principle in order to get this. So given that you know how it works in special relativity, basically, Right, so here's where, we're really going to start using the equivalence principle, right? So sort of the simple heuristics to this is, if you know how it works in special relativity, you just take your Minkowski metric, and you replace that with your curved spacetime metric, and you take your partial derivatives, and you replace those with covariant derivatives. So these are sort of the heuristics for how to cook it up in a Lagrangian in curved spacetime, if you know the one in flat spacetime. And the reason this is because you can always go to, so the reason you can do this is because you can always go to a normal coordinate system, like a Riemann normal coordinate system, where he calls them geodesic coordinate systems, and then it should look exactly the same as it does in Minkowski space. And so you can extrapolate that and then glue it together on the whole spacetime, and it just comes out that you need the covariant derivatives and the curved spacetime metric. So the Klein-Gordon field, the Lagrangian for the Klein-Gordon field, remember it's just in flat spacetime, you get the Minkowski metric here, and you just contract the partial derivatives for these, and then you get a mass term. And I guess we're putting an h-bar in there too, even though I don't think we're doing quantum mechanics now. And then the psi squared. And on curved spacetime, right, the rule of thumb is you replace the partial derivatives with covariant derivatives and the Minkowski metric with the curved spacetime metric. And then, right, so he leaves it as an exercise. You can show that if you work out the Euler-Lagrange equations for this Lagrangian, you end up with this, which is the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, okay, so I want to mention one thing, is that this sort of heuristic scheme isn't unique, actually. So this is something called the minimal coupling. Minimal coupling prescription is just doing this, basically. But that's not the only thing you can do, because if all we're demanding is that it agrees with the flat spacetime equation of motion, then you can also take something like, you know, the Klein-Gordon action. And then add on, say, so this is something people do, they add on things like this. Terms proportional to the curvature. And you think about it, right, because the curvature terms are going to disappear in the flat space-time limit. So if this is the Klein-Gordon action coming from this Lagrangian, this is still going to agree with the flat space-time case, because the curvature is going to go away. But if you took the equivalence principle to mean that in every local Lorentz frame, or every geodesic coordinate system, the equations of motion should be the same as those in special relativity, and this kind of thing would violate the equivalence principle, actually. Because remember, in a normal coordinate system, Riemann normal coordinate system, you can make the metric go to flat, the flat space-time metric, you can make the Christoffel symbols vanish, but you can't make the derivatives of the Christoffel symbols vanish. And so the curvature terms won't necessarily go away. In those cases. So you're actually going to get some sort of weird forces appearing if you go in a local Minkowski or a local Lorentz frame. And so, you know, that would violate, you know, that very strong form of the equivalence principle. But if you just take the equivalence principle to mean, okay, there exists some local Lorentz frame, then this is totally fine, because like this obeys all the right symmetries, it gives the right flat space time limit, and so on. And so I don't think, so this is something people do, is couple things directly to curvature, so couple fields directly to tidal forces, is another way of saying it. And I guess, I mean, to distinguish this from something else, you would just have to, you know, verify experimentally. Is it this way you do it, or is it some other way you do it? And that's not clear. Well, it's not clear to me. I don't actually know if anyone's ruled these out. I just know, I mean, theorists like playing around with these kind of things. So I don't know if they're really good descriptions of how things work. And now, okay, so that's a kind of ambiguity that comes up when you're going from flat spacetime to curved spacetime. So you can use the minimal coupling prescription, or you can use, so this, when you couple directly to curvature, this is called non-minimal coupling. And that's something, you know, theorists like to play around with sometimes. And actually there's, so that's one ambiguity, and there's another ambiguity that's gonna come up in a second when we talk about electromagnetism. That's, I mean, it's related to this, but it's a little bit different. Any questions so far? Real scalar fields. Got this? Okay. All right, electromagnetism. So I think Achim already talked about E&M in some lecture before. Not the equations of motion, I don't think. Okay, so electromagnetic fields. So first we're going to assume there's no charges, so just free electromagnetic fields. So we're only talking about electromagnetic waves. And we define the electromagnetic four potential as a real number valued one-form A. And then the field strength tensor, we're going to define as the exterior derivative of A. So A is a one-form, so this will be a two-form, an exact two-form. And remember, the E and B fields are just different components to the two-form F. And he says, I guess he defines this up to a factor of two, but basically like the electromagnetic field, just like the zero I components in the magnetic field are the spatial components of the field strength tensor. Okay, so if we use these rules of thumb, then the Lagrangian for the electromagnetic field should look like this. It should be two of the field strength tensors, but then you contract these two things together. So it's the first indices and the second indices contract with each other. And then he says you can work out as an exercise how to write this just in terms of forms. Okay, and now if you vary with respect to the A's, what you end up with is this. And so this is the Euler-Lagrange equation for Maxwell. And then you can recall, I think you showed this in a previous lecture, that you can write this as the co-exterior derivative acting on F and setting that equal to zero for zero charges. Now, these aren't all of Maxwell's equations, of course, because these only give you two of Maxwell's equations. The other ones are coming from this. So these are the other Maxwell's equations. But whereas this is an Euler-Lagrange equation, this one isn't. This actually just comes from the geometric description or the geometric definition of the field strength. It's just, if you write this out, or I mean, if you write this out, I guess, then in components, then you get this equation. So these are the rest of Maxwell's equations. But remember, this just comes because we defined F to be an exact form and the square of the exterior derivative is zero, so this is just automatically zero because of the geometric way we define these things. But this isn't an Euler-Lagrange equation, it's just some sort of structure equation. The Euler-Lagrange equation is this one. Right, okay, actually, before I move on, I said I'm gonna talk about this for E&M. So this is actually another ambiguity that comes up. It's kind of funny because if you look in, so special relativity with the Maxwell, actually. Or in curved space, I should say curved space time, but you know what I mean. So you get this. Now, if you write this, if you write these in terms of the the potential, and I'm going to be using in the Lorentz gauge. Lorentz gauge, and then this turns into this. Now this one, if you use a Lorentz gauge, or covariant version of the Lorentz gauge, this equation turns into this. Oh, sorry, nope. That's the whole point, it doesn't turn into that. You get that. So you get these curvature terms here. So now here's where the ambiguity comes in, because if I use sort of the minimal coupling heuristics, I would go from here, and yeah, I'd just replace that with the covariant derivative, and you get this equation. But if I were to write it in terms of the vector potential, and then use covariant derivatives here, you wouldn't get that. You get that, right? You just get this term here. So minimal coupling wouldn't give you that. So the ambiguity here is just that, okay, so where do you apply the minimal coupling prescription? Do you apply it once you have the last, you know, your favorite version of the equation of motion, or do you apply it at an earlier version? Or do you apply it at the level of the action? So again, that's just sort of an ambiguity. So you can see, actually, the way you see how these come up, if you write this out, so this gives you this term, but this, if you want to use the Lorentz gauge here, you have to commute this thing past this in order to get this. But remember, when you're acting on vector fields, when you commute two covariant derivatives past each other, you end up picking up curvature terms, right? And so the reason why this thing, going this way is different from going this way is basically because covariant derivatives don't commute with each other when acting on vector fields. That doesn't come up in the Klein-Gorin equation because you're just acting on scalar fields. When you start acting on vector fields, you have this sort of ambiguity in how you commute, you have this ambiguity because of this non-commutativity, whereas in this case, we have things commuting with each other. So it's sort of, I mean, it's sort of like superficially at least, kind of reminiscent of the ambiguities that come up in canonical quantization, actually, because we're going from a commutative to non-commutative algebra. There's an ambiguity in how you order things. In canonical quantization, though, it goes away when you send h bar equal to zero in these, but here it comes up when you send the curvature terms to zero. So that's just sort of an ambiguity that comes up here, and it's kind of related to the non-minimal coupling prescription. But the idea is it's not quite clear, not always clear, where you should apply minimal coupling. If you should apply it at the level of the action or the level of equation of motion, and which version of the equation of motion you should apply it at. And again, really, at the end of the day, you just say, okay, I'm going to study both and then figure out which, you know, experiment tells me which one's right, that kind of thing. Any questions about that? So that's kind of a cool thing, and that's something like theorists play around with, but. Yep?
Is it always safe to apply like minimal coupling at the very first stage, like at the action?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I mean, like, this is still like a legitimate, if I were to use just this, that's still like an equation of motion, right? You have to be careful about gauge invariance when you start doing this kind of thing, though, but. I think what people call minimal coupling is usually at the level of the action, yeah. That's sort of like the simplest thing to do, yeah. Yeah, and that's always a safe thing to do, for sure. Okay, any other questions? Right, so we're not really gonna talk about that too much. I just thought it was kind of cool. And you should be aware of these kind of ambiguities that come up in curved spacetime, especially because people play around with this kind of thing. Okay, now charged scalar fields or complex valued scalar fields. And so these kind of fields describe things like charged pi mesons. And the reason you consider these, well, I mean, they're particles, so you should consider them. But theoretically, you play around with these because it lets you couple to electromagnetism. So we're going to talk about these complex valued scalar fields coupled to electromagnetism. And so if we just use this minimal coupling, so minimal coupling to the gauge covariant derivative and to the space-time, curved space-time, then you end up with something that looks like this. Right, so this is the gauge covariant derivative version of the Klein-Gordon equation, where you have these coupling to the electromagnetic potentials, and the mass term for the scalar field and the free Maxwell term. And now, okay, so Achim has this note here that why do you consider these complex? Because you can show that these cross terms, so this term with this term and that term with that term, if these were real, then those cross terms would vanish. And then he has a short proof of it here. It's not, I mean, you just work it out. It's pretty easy to see that if these are real, those the cross terms vanish. And those are the terms responsible for the Lorentz force. So if you have a real scalar field, you're not going to have a Lorentz force. One weird thing is, I think, the diamagnetic term here doesn't vanish for a scalar field. I don't actually know what that means, but that term doesn't come up when you couple things to fermions. But right, so that's how you do scalar fields, charged scalar fields coupled to electromagnetism on curved spacetime. That's what it looks like, or that's what Lagrangian looks like. And then it's not too hard to, I mean, it might be a little tedious, but to work out the equations of motion, there are the Lagrange equations. So you have two coupled fields now, so you have two variations, or two Euler-Lagrange equations. So the first one you vary with respect to the complex scalar field, or the conjugate of the complex scalar field, and that gives you an Euler-Lagrange equation for just the psi field, and it looks like this. So you have a Klein-Gordon part here, that's sort of, it's analogous to the free part. And then you have all this junk here, which is the charged scalar field coupled to electromagnetic potential. And so, right, so psi is going to be affected by A because of these terms. If you were to vary respect to psi instead of psi star, then you just get the same equation but complex conjugated. So it doesn't really give you anything much new. And now when you vary respect the Lagrangian from the last page with respect to the vector potential, what you get is the free Maxwell part, and then all this junk, which is just saying how A is affected by these charged scalar fields. And then if you're so inclined, I mean, you can write this as like a current if you really want. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. Any questions? All right, spinners. Okay, right, so now we want to describe fermions. So remember, fermions are described in special relativity by the Dirac equation. He's saying with units such that h bar equals 1, but I mean, you can talk about the Dirac equation without quantum mechanics, so you don't really need h bar in there. That's just an old relativistic quantum mechanics thing. And so remember, the Dirac equation in special relativity looks like this. So we have these psi fields are these four component fields, which are called spinners. So in four dimensions, it's four components, and these are called spinners, describing spin 1/2 particles like electrons. And remember, these gamma matrices are just 4x4 matrices that obey this algebra. So you want the anti-commutator between the two of them to be equal to twice the Minkowski metric, or the components of the Minkowski metric. And then the internal indices, so these are matrices, and then the matrix part of this equation is just the identity. So we're just suppressing the identity there. Okay, and remember, why do we want this algebra to hold? Well, because remember, the motivation for this is that Dirac wanted a first-order relativistic wave equation. So the trick was to basically take the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation. So we choose the algebra of those Dirac matrices so that if we take the Dirac operator acting on the spinners and the adjoint of the Dirac operator, you can and you act them two together, you know just expand it out. These two terms will cancel, and you just get the mass squared term and then this thing here. But because this is symmetric in the two indices, you can, and if these, the anti-symmetric part of this, of the product here is going to vanish, so you can just write out the symmetric part like this. And then if these obey this equation, then you can just sub in the twice the Minkowski metric here, and you just end up with the Klein-Gordon equation. And also the identity in the spinner space. So just each component of this is going to obey the Klein-Gordon. Okay, so that's just how it works in flat space. Now, how does it work in GR? Well, okay, so there's two things we have to do, right? One is have to figure out this thing, because this we're going to map it to some kind of covariant derivative, but we haven't talked about how covariant derivatives act on spinners. So I'm going to get to that in a minute, but we also have to talk about these gamma matrices too, because if these gamma matrices anti-commute to the Minkowski metric on curved spacetime, they should probably commute to the curved spacetime metric. So this is a bit terse here, so I'm gonna talk about this a little bit more. So remember, you can always find, remember that, I think it was in one of the last lectures, Achim talked about tetrads, right? So he said you can pick any coordinate or any frame you want in the tangent bundle in order to provide coordinates for your tangent section or your vector fields, right? So he talked about having things like, so if you had two vectors and you feed those into the metric, this gives you some components of the metric, but not necessarily, coordinate vector fields. So what we're going to do here is appeal to the equivalence principle. So what we're going to say is that, so remember, we can always choose at every point. So I'm going to write it like this. As a kind of completeness relation. So if you just think at a single point, you can always find matrices, two matrices, that diagonalize this to make it look like the Minkowski metric, right? That's just like in a Riemann normal coordinate system or something. But we can do that at every point. So if we keep track of the matrices we used to do this at every point, we can glue all those together and come up with these space-time dependent matrices that look like this. Now these things aren't unique because we can always like, so these things aren't unique because I can always do like a Lorentz transformation inverse here and here. So on these indices, it's not unique because in these indices I can always do a Lorentz transformation, but I can always find some tetrad fields that cause the metric to become diagonal in this basis. And so that's how we're going to appeal the equivalence principle here. But how does that help us find these gamma matrices? Well, see, what we're after is a set of gamma matrices that do this, if we're just going to do sort of the curved space-time analog of this thing, right? But then this seems like a very tedious thing to try to do, right? Because, at every point, I have some metric or inverse metric, and I have to find some set of matrices that anti-commute to that, but they're going to be different at every point in space-time, so that seems like it's going to be a tedious thing to try to find them all. But it's actually, if you use this, there's a simple way to find all of them. All you do is use the flat space-time ones, then use the tetrads to map that into the curved space-time one. And then if you work this out, then it's not too hard to show that basically it works out to this, if you use the tetrad fields. So that's why that's one reason why tetrads are really useful. And if you're working with spinners on curved space-time, you always want to do things like this. You always want to work in a local Lorentz frame. What else was I going to say here? Right. So that's why these tetrads are useful, because basically what are they saying? They're telling you they're mapping the Minkowski space into the curved space-time, right? So they're telling you basically how your light cones are embedded in your space-time, because what they're doing is they're taking things from Minkowski space and just mapping them to things in the curved space-time, like these gamma matrices, right? We know how it works in the flat space-time, and then the tetrad just tells you, okay, just take that, this flat space-time one, map it through the tetrad, and you get how it works in curved space-time, right? And so that's really why people like using tetrads, because it, you know, they're just maps that tell you how the vector space, the light cones are embedded in the curved space-time. Right. And so, I mean, some people, when I work with this, I like to work with these things, but here we're actually just going to expand the whole thing out and just talk about it, like keep these things separate, and just all the gamma matrices later on are just going to be the flat space-time ones, but remember that it's just because we're talking about how it works in the flat space-time and then mapping it through the curved space-time one. Okay, so once we have that, we can motivate the form of the Dirac equation in curved space-time to look something like this. So right, because remember, flat space-time one looked like this, so basically we want to use the curved gammas and the covariant derivatives here. But if we use the tetrads here, then we can just use the flat space-time ones here. So these are the flat space-time gammas, because we're working in the orthonormal frame. So now the question is, what is this? Because we've talked about, you know, how covariant derivatives act on vector fields, how they act on scalar fields, and how they act on forms, just using the Leibniz rule. But that's not enough to tell us how they should act on spinner fields. So we have to figure out, okay, what's this going to look like on spinner fields? Well, right, so basically the idea, we're going to try to remember what covariant derivatives actually do. So what covariant derivatives do, remember, they generate parallel transport. So actually what the connections are doing are generating infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. So the idea is that if a covariant derivative is what you use to do parallel transport, it should also do parallel transport on spinners. And then if the parallel transport, remember, if you move it along the tangent space, like a vector field along the tangent space, it's going to do some kind of Lorentz transformation. So the idea is on spinners, it should do the same Lorentz transformation, but in the spinner representation. So that's sort of the idea. It should do the same Lorentz transformation, or infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, but in the spinner representation. And so I'm going to, so that's the idea, and I'm going to talk about, I think the last few slides are talking about how to do that. So infinitesimal parallel transport. It looks like this, right? Because this generates the parallel transport. So if you have some vector, you do infinitesimal parallel transport, you get the same vector plus the connection covariant derivative acting on the vector field. I guess we're talking about tetrad fields here, but whatever. It's a basis, so it doesn't matter. Remember, this acting on this in this orthonormal frame, it gives you a Lorentz algebra valued one form. So it's this omega matrix. I think Achim defined it two lectures ago or last lecture or something. Right, it feeds in a vector field and gives you a matrix that tells you how the vector is rotating under parallel transport. Right, and why is this a Lorentz transformation? Well, there are a few ways of seeing it. One way of thinking about it is that parallel transport preserves inner products and angles. Inner products, I guess. So it preserves lengths as you parallel transport, because that's how we define the Leibniz rule, right? And so when you parallel transport a vector to another point, if its length doesn't change, then that's just going to be a rotation, or one plus three signature, it's going to be a Lorentz transformation. So remember, a Lorentz transformation we can write like this. That's the idea, but a Lorentz transformation we can write like this on a vector. And then if you just expand that infinitesimally, you get a set of Lie algebra value elements of the Lorentz transformation. And then these are anti-commuting, because remember, I think he showed before that the components of these are anti-commuting, and that's how the components, the coefficients of Lorentz transformations are supposed to change. They're supposed to be anti-commuting things. So that's why these generate infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. But physically, it's sort of clear why that should be. Right, so the idea is we want to try to do that same thing on spinners. So remember in special relativity, we're just going to expand our spinners like something like this. I think that's just repeating the same things I said. Yeah, so we're going to define some basis for our spinner space and just expand our spinners here. So we're just decoupling the coefficient function from some spinner basis. We don't really care what that is for now. And then if we have a covariant derivative acting on our spinner, well, we know how it's going to act on our coordinate functions, right? So all we have to figure out is how it acts on these basis of spinners. So, and this is sort of an analogy to how we defined for an arbitrary tetrad, how we define the covariant derivative acting on the basis elements of the tetrad, right? And they give this thing. The omega there was by definition, right? Okay. So, right, in special relativity, we know that the Lorentz transformation, infinitesimal Lorentz transformations look like this, where these are anti-commuting. In these indices, if you were to lower them. And so vectors transform like this. So now we have to figure out what the infinitesimal generators of Lorentz transformations are in the spinner representation. Now he just states it and he says it looks like this. And that's true. If you want to look this up, you can go to any QFT textbook that does like particle physics with fermions. And they'll derive this. So he has a quick small note here, which I can't even read from up here. Okay. Okay, never mind. I was going to zoom in, but apparently I can't. Right, so he talks about where these come from, and he uses the idea that you have some This is sort of motivated from quantum mechanics, is you have some unitary representation of the Lorentz group acting on some field, and that generates, or sorry, this is translations, actually. So you have some unitary representation of the translations acting on some operator, some operator valued field, and that generates translation like this. And then basically in field theory, you try to do the same thing with Lorentz transformations. I don't really want to appeal to sort of operators to do this. So another way to do it is just think of, like, it was Dirac's original motivation, basically. It's just that, okay, Dirac showed if you have a set of matrices obeying these anti-commutation relations, then you can define these things like this, so the commutator of the two gamma matrices. And I usually define it with I over 4. I don't know if that's going to be consistent here, but you can check it. And then if you define these things, then these obey the commutation relations of Lorentz algebra. And you can just work that out. I'm not going to try to work it out because I don't remember all the indices, but it's a whole bunch of anti-symmetrized indices. Right, but you can show those obey the Lorentz algebra, and then you can define spinners to be objects in the representation space of this of these generators. So that's how I do it. Another way you can... I'll get to that in a minute. There's another way you can, a more geometric way you can think about that too. But basically, this 1/4 and these are these generators here. And then the omega here is just the components of the Lorentz transformation, of the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, right? So this gives you the generators, the basis of generators for the Lorentz transformation. These are the components of it. And then this whole thing tells you how an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acts on a spinner. Right, so this is for special relativity. Now, applying it to general relativity, it's basically the same idea, because as long as we go to an orthonormal frame or some local Lorentz frame, we just have to use these omegas after we're feeding in the direction we're going in, the direction we're doing the parallel transport, you feed in a vector field, and then you get the components of this thing. And so these are the components of the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And then, right, okay, I guess we're talking about vectors again. And then when you're acting on vectors, these are the components, right? And then then this is how it acts just on vectors. Right, and then that's how you define the covariant derivative for vectors, by how it acts on the frame. So the idea is, when we talk about spinners, we should take the same components. So because the direction in which you're parallel transporting is still defined by a vector field, so or some frame, so you're still going to feed it a vector field, and that'll still give you the components. Remember, we want it to be the same components as the Lorentz transformation we did for the vector field. And so we use these same components, but now we're going to use the generators of the spinner representation. The generators of the Lorentz algebra and the spinner representation. And because we're working in orthonormal Lorentz frame, we can still work with this flat space-time gamma matrices. And those are still going to give us the right generators. And so our infinitesimal parallel transport is just given by this. And so what we can do is define the covariant derivative acting on this basis of spinners as this thing. And so this is called a spin connection. And so this is how we do covariant derivatives of spinners on curved spacetimes. And so for a general spinner, right, so this is for the basis on the of the spinner space. And so for a general spinner, we expand it in that basis in which we define this connection, and then just demand that it obeys the Leibniz rule. So we work that out. So we act on the coordinate functions, and then we act on the spinners. And what that gives you is just this. And that's pretty easy to see, I think. That last bit. OK, so now we have the covariant derivatives for the spinners, and we have these gamma matrices. So then we can just declare this to be the Kerr space-time Dirac equation. So it's just the gamma matrices with the spin covariant derivative acting on spinners. And then you still have the mass term. That doesn't change. And then if you want to work that out in components, in spinner components, you can work it out something like that. OK, so this last remark, I think, would basically take me an entire lecture to explain. So this isn't going to come up later. He just wants to connect it to some of the things you were doing before. So we have this Dirac operator. It's this object here. Right. And this Dirac operator, you can define as acting on sort of the space of these gamma matrices, in a sense, or the Kerr space-time gamma matrices. And it turns out the set of gamma matrices and the set of, and so the vector space of the gamma matrices and the Grassmann algebra on your Kerr space-time are isomorphic as vector spaces. If you think of the Clifford algebra on your spacetime, it's basically the algebra of these Kerr spacetime Dirac matrices. So the algebra is spanned by, you know, one, gamma, things like gamma, products of gammas. And you can keep going. And then remember the Grassmann algebra is spanned by things like this. Right, with wedge products. And then it turns out there's a canonical isomorphism between these two things as vector spaces. They're actually completely different algebras. But as vector spaces, they're isomorphic to each other. And then if you think about what this is, you can define what this means acting on these things. And then it's a linear operator acting on these. And so you can use this vector space isomorphism to pull it back to get the representation of the Dirac operator on this Grassmann algebra. And it turns out when you do that, you get something that looks like this. Now there's a lot of stuff going on there, so I can't work out or tell you exactly how that works, but maybe one way to convince you that's plausible is because remember what Dirac operators are supposed to be. They're supposed to be sort of like a square root of the Klein-Gordon of the D'Alembertian operator. So if you look at this thing, D plus delta, if you just squared this thing, you get back d delta plus delta d, right? Which is what we defined before as our Laplacian on forms. So it's at least plausible that that's some kind of Dirac operator acting on it. But the relation between the Grassmann algebra and the Clifford algebra, there's a lot to say there. If you want, you can look it up. But that's just, Achim wanted to connect that to other things you guys were talking about. OK, so I think I'm done. That's it. Any questions? No. OK. OK, well, that's it for this lecture. And so that's equations of motion. Next time, Achim's going to be talking about stress energy tensors and energy conditions and things like that. So thanks.